Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 17th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. Since Lyndon LaRouche's announcement in his July 25th, 2007 webcast that the financial system had already crashed, we've seen a series of developments which have confirmed that forecast. There's a so-called subprime crisis in which 2 to 3 million families have lost their homes or are in the process of doing so through foreclosure. There's the so-called credit crunch, the freezing up of interbank lending due to the insolvency of the so-called assets of the banks, largely due to the insanity of Alan Greenspan and his financial innovations. And a move in the hyperinflation, as LaRouche had forecast earlier, as central bankers have been pumping huge amounts of liquidity into the frozen system, and speculators are using that money not for new productive loans, but for short-term speculation in commodities. This process of commodity speculation, coming on top of decisions of the last two decades, dictated out of London to deregulate economies and to impose free trade policies in an effort to eliminate the right of nation states to act to defend their citizens, has created a situation which now threatens the lives of between 1 and 2 billion people on the planet, a combination of hyperinflation of food prices and food shortages. While international agencies have finally begun to discuss this crisis, the actions they have proposed are grossly inadequate. About 10 days ago, Helga Zepp LaRouche issued an emergency call for doubling food production and to kill the World Trade Organization in a way that would have both addressed the immediate crisis as well as reverse the collapse caused by the deliberate imposition of genocidal policies by the financial and political forces of the Anglo-Dutch Empire. Helga will be our guest today to discuss this and her initiative to build some motion before the Food and Agriculture Organization meet in Rome on June 3rd. Helga, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
Why don't you give us your updated picture of this food crisis and then tell us about your call to address it?
Well, I think the fact that since October last year there were hunger crises and hunger riots in more than 40 nations, especially naturally in the developing countries, and you know there was actually a block out by the media until sometimes in April, even if these riots took place since October and since the head of the FAO, Jacques Diouf, already in December had called for an emergency food, especially seed, for poor farmers for the planting season this spring of something like a miserable $17 million dollars, that is only millions. This money could not be raised. So Jacques Diouf at a conference in Brazil last week basically accused the rich countries of not having an intent to help the poor countries. Now, I think it is probably not precise to say rich countries, it's much more important to focus on the institutions which prevent an effective help, which is essentially the WTO. Because if you look into the reasons why there is such a double crisis of both food shortage and hyperinflation, it is very much the WTO and the idea of having complete free trade and neoliberal policies affecting agriculture, and especially by treating agricultural products as if they were a product like any other product you could speculate on. I mean, it's one thing if you speculate on TV sets or on gold or but it's something completely different if you're speculating with the very ingredient which means the livelihood and the ability of billions of people to live. So that's why I have called for a dissolution of the WTO, because rather than responding to this crisis, the WTO right now is gearing up their efforts to complete the so-called Doha round. That's the, you know, the essentially the trade negotiations which started in 2001 and which have really gotten nowhere, where right now the WTO and the European Union and, you know, various other institutions, they want to finish this so-called Doha round, which would be a complete liberalization of the food markets and other markets by the end of May or beginning of June. And the reason why they have such a hurry is because they figure that it takes the governments about half a year to implement the modalities, and they want to have all of this basically finished and, you know, completed before the Bush administration leaves the White House. So, you know, they are completely indifferent to the hunger crisis. They are not changing their views. And, you know, that's why I have said, you know, forget these interests, because, you know, the only beneficiaries of this WTO policy are the big food cartels like Cargill, Nestle, Monsanto,
yeah.
And naturally the speculators who have not only started to speculate in biofuel, and the biofuel is responsible for about 10 to 20% of the price increase of the food, but they also have started to speculate on food as such. So that's totally immoral, and that's why I have said, no, we have to take a completely different approach. We have to focus on the existing world population, which is 6.5 billion people, and we have to not only, you know, produce enough food so that those people right now who are affected by the high prices, especially in the developing countries, and who are actually, you know, threatened with starvation, which, you know, is anywhere between 1 but more likely 2 billion people. But we also have to take into account that by the year 2050, in all likelihood, and hopefully we will have 3 billion more people. So therefore, you know, you have 2 billion undernourished, threatened with starvation right now, plus hopefully 3 billion more people by the year 2050. So therefore, the idea of doubling food production is a very good measuring rod to get the idea of what will be required to avoid the biggest human catastrophe ever.
So the two points then are dissolve the WTO and double food production. Is there any impediment, any economic or physical impediment that you know of that would prevent us from doubling food production?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, you know, the you have right now, in any case, you know, you cannot, I mean, you have to remember that there are people such as Prince Philip of the World Wildlife Fund, Lester Brown of, you know, the Food Watch, and others who have asked in the past that there should be a massive reduction of the world population. You know, people were talking about reducing the world population to 2 billion or even 1 billion. Prince Philip is infamous for having said that he wants to be reincarnated as a deadly virus to help to deal with the so-called overpopulation problem. But you cannot have policies which, in fact, are doing that or are threatening to do that without that you have a major, major resistance of any country which is not completely immoral or insane. And therefore, you have right now already, even without, you know, formally dissolving the WTO, you have a whole bunch of countries which are no longer listening to the WTO or to the IMF conditionalities, which, you know, basically told them over the last decades that, you know, they should not have food self-sufficiency, they should not have, you know, basically an effort to take care of themselves, but should only rely on the world market. Countries are abandoning that, and they are going for self-sufficiency and food security, simply because, you know, I mean, these countries know perfectly well that, you know, a government which is not doing that right now is in danger of being swept away by riots, by revolutions. And even Strauss-Kahn, the present head of the IMF, was warning that if there is no change in policy, it may even come to wars between countries over the question of food. But there are also some very positive developments, and I'm very happy to tell you that just in the last week, there was an extremely important meeting in Russia, in Yekaterinburg, where China, India, and Russia in one meeting, and China, India, Russia, and Brazil in another meeting, basically increased their strategic partnership. And especially Russia, China, and India said that they want to cooperate on an international and regional level. And basically, one of the most important points they raised is that the food crisis can be solved, and that they basically want to put this on the agenda at the FAO meeting in Rome, beginning of June. And I think this is very, very good, because especially Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, very proudly said that these four countries are the world's fastest growing economies. And, you know, that therefore they will basically do everything to ensure food security, not only for themselves, but for others. Now, I'm absolutely sure that if the United States and Europe, if they do not attend to the basic self, existential needs of the developing countries, which is centered around food, but also, obviously, you know, if they want to be self-sufficient, they need infrastructure, they need the means to develop their own food production. If Europe and the United States are not responding to that, then the gravity center of the world will shift in a decisive way to this new strategic partnership of Russia, China, and India, because, you know, why should African countries not work with Russia and with China and India when these countries are developing the infrastructure in the different African nations, and the United States and Europe are doing it not? So I think it's a very good development, and I really hope that we can swing the attitude in the United States and Europe on this issue.
So you're listening to Helga Zepp LaRouche. This is the LaRouche Show for May 17th, 2008. We will have at least someone from the LaRouche Youth Movement on shortly, Helga. But I'd like to just pursue two aspects of this, because this is the first one is on the question of the intention for the crisis. It's been clear for a number of years that you have people, as you mentioned, Lester Brown, Prince Philip, there's a whole list of them, the Club of Rome, there was Kissinger's murderous National Security Study Memo 200. There's a clear intention to reduce population using food and food shortages. Yet most of the countries involved, many countries I should say, for example in Europe, there's a huge fight right now over how far to go in cutting back agriculture, getting rid of the Common Agricultural Plan. So what do we see in the way of resistance, the potential for resistance, people who could take up your call going into this, besides the, you mentioned the Russia, China, India, very promising developments there. But is there a constituency, for example, in Europe and the United States, that would fight for this policy?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, I'm very, very optimistic that we will be able to force this issue of doubling the food production through, simply because anybody who is against it exposes himself or herself as a completely immoral, moron who you know, has only money in their mind and speculation and profit and not the well-being of the people. For example, while for a very long time the European nations went along with the different neoliberal reforms, first in the process of GATT, and then, this was escalated with the WTO, And a lot of idiotic policies have been implemented, like, for example, the set-aside policy that farmers would get subsidies for not producing, for, you know, basically throwing away milk beyond a certain quota, for using, you know, basically subsidies for landscaping. I mean, this was completely insane. That's why I'm saying that the WTO policy over the last years, maybe even, you know, almost two decades, has reduced the capacities which are one of the causes for this scarcity. But in the recent period, you know, there was a recognition on the part of several European factions that this is crazy and is completely, you know, intolerable. For example, the French agricultural minister, Michel Barnier, came out and had now for weeks a huge fight with the Financial Times, where the Financial Times, acting as the spokes organ for the British Empire, is demanding that the last remnants of the European Common Agricultural Policy, the so-called CAP, should be eliminated. Now, the CAP is a very good policy which comes from the period of de Gaulle and Adenauer, and it basically says that, you know, the governments have to take care that there is always abundant food at reasonable prices and guaranteeing a good living standard for the producers, you know, which is a perfectly healthy policy. Now, obviously, the European Union, Agricultural Commissioner, a terrible woman from Denmark with the name of Fischer Boel, and the British themselves, they are demanding a smashing of this cap. And Barnier basically said, no, not only is this absolutely crucial for the French agriculture, which, as you know, is playing a very important role for the French economy as a whole, but Barnier also said that it's a very good model for Africa, for Latin America, and other regions of the world. So they should have a protectionist agricultural policy. Now, naturally, the freak out of the neoliberal, you know, reformers is gigantic. But fortunately, on this point, Barnier got the support of Seehofer, who is the German agricultural minister, and very powerful now also by the new economic and finance minister from Italy, Tremonti, who, you know, basically came out and very, very strongly said that, you know, the Europeans must expand agricultural production, eliminate biofuel, and go with nuclear energy. He basically said, you know, that he quoted the anti-globalist forces saying that the biofuel is a crime against humanity. And, you know, so this is very, very good. And Tremonti, for example, was then supported by the Italian Farmers Association, the Confederazione Italiana Agricoltori. And, you know, I know also that a lot of farm organizations in Germany are supporting this. The Irish farmers are probably escalating their fight against the Lisbon Treaty on the very grounds that if the WTO European Union negotiations would go through, it would reduce the European agricultural capacities again by up to 20%, which in face of this world hunger would be really completely insane.
Absolutely. If you have questions for Helga Zepp-LaRouche, we can take your email questions, send them to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub, LARoucheP.com. And I also want to call our listeners' attention to the most recent issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, the May 9th issue, which has in it very prominently Helga's article, which is the article with the call for the effort to put on the agenda of the world Food and Agriculture Organization, this approach of getting rid of the WTO and doubling food production. And if you're interested in getting some literature You can download some of it from LaRouchePack.com, or you can call us at 800-278-3135. We'll give you that number again later. It's 800-278-3135. Helga, you just mentioned one of the other areas which indicates the deliberate intent behind these forces to create food shortages as a way of imposing their globalized policies. You mentioned the biofuels and also the global warming hoax. I mean, there seem to be two aspects to this. One is no development of new technology in agriculture in the Southern Hemisphere. In other words, just cheap subsistence labor producing cheap food for the so-called advanced sector countries. And, of course, the other side is using food for fuel. So I wonder if you could just comment on that, because you've been one of the people out front on this issue for a long time, and I think it's we're now beginning to see the situation turn in the United States against Al Gore and biofuels, but I wonder if you could just give us how this fits into this whole global food crisis.
Well, I fully agree with people like Jean Ziegler, the special rapporteur to the United Nations, or the Indian finance minister, and many others who have said that the diversion of food into biofuel is a crime against humanity. Because, you know, when you have hunger riots in 40 countries, if you have officially somewhere between 900 million people who are on the verge of starvation and about 2 billion people altogether who are undernourished and who have hunger, then the very idea to transform the higher quality food into the lower quality biofuel is absolutely insane. And, you know, it is basically, you know, a way just to have a new bubble, because after the, you know, after the new economy collapsed in 2000, and with the collapse of the mortgage market in the United States and the following financial crisis worldwide, they need a new bubble for speculation. And one of the bubbles is, apart from energy and oil, it is food products as such, but it is also biofuel, because it's a gigantic industry. If you look how many plants have been built to transform corn and wheat and other foodstuffs into biofuel, it's a whole new industry, but it is economically absolutely insane. Now, it is
immoral. In fact, it requires significant government subsidies to survive from the same people who say you shouldn't have any government subsidies.
Absolutely. And it doesn't do anything for the environment either, so it's a complete hoax. And fortunately, I think that, you know, we have now a very open field. For example, we have pamphlets out, we have leaflets out, we are mobilizing the population. And given the fact that many of these biofuels are not very good for the cars either, many car owners and also some car associations are now saying, hey, wait a second, this was not such a good idea. But, you know, I think that, I mean, it is simply, you know, you have, I think you have to differentiate between those greedy, you know, money-loving people who just would not care if their profit of today has consequences of thousands and millions of people dying. And I think these people, you know, they will not last in this crisis, because, you know, I mean, we are going into a decision. Either we put the world back on a moral ground, or we will have a dark age, and then nobody will be happy, and these people neither. But I think you already hinted, you know, that behind that is really this empire faction of people who basically say, you know, the whole world should be run by supranational institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, the European Union, NATO, and they should run everything at the expense of the nation state, which happens to be the only institution which can defend the common good in a period of crisis like now. And they could not care less if people die. As a matter of fact, you have right now a very clear effort by the British Empire to recolonize Africa. You have an effort by the Anglo-American, special relationship to, basically recolonize India, to put maximum pressure on Russia, on China. You have an effort to really, divide these countries and separate them and even go for territorial, separation of Tibet, of Xinjiang, of previously Sichuan. And I think it is all of this perception that, you also have to see that all of these countries realize the dollar is collapsing, the U.S. is falling into a depression, you have an effort to, cause wars and mischief all over the place. Mm-hmm. And that is the dynamic why you have right now Russia, China, and India in particular forming this new strategic alliance. This is a very, very clear response to both the unilateralism of the Bush administration, but also to the East expansion of NATO and the European Union. So, I think that, if I'm saying that we have to replace these institutions and go back to a policy which, John Quincy Adams called once the alliance of perfectly sovereign nation states working together for a common good of civilization, then that is the only way to go.
Well, I'd like to add a brief editorial comment. It's about time that some of these international leaders are making these kinds of statements that these kinds of policies are a crime against humanity. This is something Lyndon LaRouche has been addressing. You've been addressing it for years, that there are consequences to these kinds of policies that destroy nation states. The attacks recently in The Economist and the Financial Times against food self-sufficiency, these ought to bring people to trial for those kind of comments because they have consequences. So it is clear that we're entering a totally new moment in history with potential for this. I know, Helga, we're getting a couple of questions on the Russia-India-China relationship, and I'll come back to those in just a moment. If you have a question for Helga Zepp-LaRouche, you can email it to us at radio@larouchepub.com. I'd like to bring on Tim Vance right now, LaRouche Youth Movement organizer who's in Houston. Tim is involved in organizing for a town meeting later this month. I believe we're going to be setting up town meetings in a number of U.S. cities as part of your call, Helga, to affect the policy deliberations at the Food and Agriculture Organization meeting in Rome. Tim, what are you up to these days?
I'd like to first start off by informing Helga and the audience that we here in Texas are going to do our part to bring Helga's alternative agenda to the FAO conference, but then we're going to bring it right back home to Austin for the Texas Democratic State Convention, which, as it turns out, begins the evening that the FAO conference ends. And so I think we'll have a lot of good work to bring into it. One thing our youth have done over the past week is begin to reach out to a number of associations that deal directly with the industries in agriculture and ranching. We got our hands on the Farm and Ranch Association directory, and we've been having a lot of fun with that. And so by phone and then also through personal visits in Austin, we've been able to reach a number of them. And I'd say, let's see, we've gotten responses from Agricultural Aviation, the Teachers Association, FFA.
That's Future Farmers of America.
Future Farmers of America. And across the board, we're getting universal recognition of the importance of doubling food production. That has not been questioned at all by the
Tim, are you finding that the reactions are going beyond just people worried about higher food prices, that it's easy to get people to see that this is connected to a much more serious global breakdown?
Well, I think when you push the point, it becomes provocative. I think it's most provocative for people if you insist on this as being an intentional policy of genocide. I think that's where it really causes people to look at this in a different light than maybe, you know, the way it's put in the news media. But yeah, if you just put it to them directly, this is genocide, you get the most serious responses.
Okay, well, Tim. Yeah, we'll come back to you in a moment, Tim. I think Fletcher has a question for Helga from an email from Fred Unifeld, someone you know quite well, Helga, from the board of the
yes.
International Schiller Institute. Fletcher, go ahead.
I'm going to read that, and I'm going to read an additional related question that came in from somebody in Rennes, France.
Okay, go ahead.
Fred's question is, he says he's excited to be working with you on your call, Helga. He's already gotten the Gannett News Star to publish an article he wrote on the topic, and he's working with others around the United States, including farm organizations. He says, is there a limit to population growth? And then from David in Rennes, he says, in regard to the actual situation of food shortages in the whole world, how many times and in what way or will we be able to double the food production? I find it so big that I don't know where we could begin.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think we have to worry about the limits of population growth. Because already in the 30s, there was a very important economist of the German trade union movement who actually had a similar policy like Franklin D. Roosevelt, and his name was Bade, and he was one of the authors of the famous VTB, Wojtynski-Bade-Tarnow plan, which was essentially a new deal for Germany, which unfortunately was not implemented, but, you know, it was absolutely the same approach like what Roosevelt did with the New Deal, and it would have really helped to overcome the Depression and would have avoided Hitler's rise to power if it would have been implemented. So this Bade is a very important economist, and he wrote a book, as I said, in the 30s, where he said that with then existing technologies, he was convinced that it would be possible to feed 600 billion people on this planet. Now, I think that that is absolutely the way to look at it, because if you look at how many areas are presently absolutely thinly populated, for example, you have all the deserts. Now, Mr. LaRouche has proposed for many years a way of reconquering these deserts and turn them into agriculturally usable lands, into forests, into gardens, by simply producing new fresh water. And the only way how you can do that is basically by developing inherently safe nuclear energy with the high temperature reactor, the pebble bed reactor, which is presently developed both in China, in South Africa, and I also think Japan is working on it. So then you could desalinate large quantities of ocean water and then use it for irrigation. And that way you could really already, you know, reconquer very, very large parts of the world.
You're also talking about policies that will create millions of new jobs.
Absolutely. But then you have also other areas which are presently not habited very much, like if you look at Russia, which is totally thinly populated, all the far east of Russia, there are, you know, almost no people. The Russian government right now is involved in major projects to, you know, make the areas which are under permafrost conditions, you know, usable and make it possible for people to live there, which obviously requires tremendous investments. Then naturally, you know, I think that all the different mountain areas which are not inhabited and so forth. So I'm not worried about that. And then, you know, if we go the optimistic way, you know, just think, you know, how people were thinking about space in the Kennedy era, when you had the Apollo project, the idea that men would eventually not only go to the moon, but that we would have Mars missions, and that would just be the beginning of, really conquering space. There are many things. It is not our immediate problem. If you start with the $600 billion by Bade, that gives us enough time to then think about how we proceed from there. So I think that is really the way to look at it.
Okay.
Now, concerning the immediate question of the doubling, as I said, it is on the one side, naturally, if you would cut out immediately, and that's the measure you could do right away, it would not cause any additional problem, but you could do it really this instant, just cut out the biofuel, and you would have, anywhere between 10% and 20% more food right away, or at least in the next harvest. You wouldn't, maybe you would not be able to use the present like raps oil and so forth for food. But, latest, in the next planting season, you could really stop this. And you could stop using wheats and maize and corn right away, obviously. So then you have the next step, which obviously would be to stop cash crop for export, because it is immoral and totally crazy to force third world countries to export cheap cash crops in order to pay a debt which is only the result of completely unjust IMF conditionalities imposed on these countries, and take away food from them when these countries are starving themselves. So an immediate stop to cash crop export and an immediate turn of this production into subsistence agriculture would already make a big difference. Several countries in the third world have really already taken consequences out of this present situation and are trying to get to food self-subsistence, like, for example, Senegal, under the leadership of President Wade. They basically want to have self-subsistence in a very short period of time. Also, other countries like Malaysia, Philippines, and Malawi, many other countries are going in this direction. And I think this will be the trend of the future. Now, obviously, the problem in many countries is that they don't have irrigation. For example, if you take a country like Sudan, Sudan has one of the most fertile soils in the whole world. They could easily have 3 or 4 harvests a year if they would have irrigation. Right now, 98% of their agriculture is dependent on the rainfall, which, means sometimes they have good agricultural products and beef and other herds, and then for years they don't. So obviously, therefore, the question of irrigation, water management. Mm-hmm. In other countries, you have too much water, you have to make channels, you have to basically control the water from flooding. Then you need urgently roads, you need infrastructure, because if you don't have infrastructure, you cannot even, transport the harvest. Then you need urgently food processing, because, if you have large food production in countries, which don't have so much population, Sudan is a good example, but who could export abundant food for countries which are in urgent need of food import, like China, like Japan, like others. You need a very good transport system, you need food reprocessing, you need food irradiation, so that, the food is not spoiling. And if you do all of these things, build ports, build railway, build infrastructure, build an infrastructure grid for Africa and Latin America, which is not less developed than that of Europe, You know, and if you go from Europe, from, you know, the Black Sea to the North Sea, you can easily travel from one river to the next by a channel. Then you have containerized main stations where you can go to trains and to trucks. So all of this is infrastructure which is absolutely required. And therefore, you know, this is really what is needed. And that is one of the reasons, by the way, why, you know, China especially, but to a lesser degree also Russia and India, why they have so excellent relations with many African countries. Because, you know, the Chinese, they have relations with African countries. Naturally, they have their own interest by getting raw material import, but they also take care of the interest of these countries by building infrastructure, building railway, building dams, building irrigation systems. So it is a reciprocal interest, which is exactly what the Peace of Westphalia policy requires, you know, that you have a mutual interest taking care on both sides, and that way both sides are happy. So I can only say, rather than freaking out about the Chinese influence in Africa, if the United States and the European nations would do the same thing, it would be better for them and it would be better for the Africans as well.
Well, Helga, we're getting a number of calls or a number of emails coming in. I would just add to what you just said, this is also the absolute necessity for the New Bretton Woods, because the current monetary system, besides being broken down, is the cause of the problem. And the, you and your husband have been fighting for years for this New Bretton Woods system, and it's obvious that you're not going to be able to do this kind of development without implementing it. But let me go back to Fletcher has a, I think, an email from Los Angeles and possibly another one. Fletcher?
Well, I'm going to read this one that was directly relevant to what Helga was saying about infrastructure. This is from Santiago Hilaret, who seems to be writing from Germany. He says he's asking about preservation, storage, and transportation of food. He says, I ask this because a key source of the ominous power that the closely held grain cartel has appears to be centered around the capacity of these genocidal operations to have control over most of the existing grain storage and transport infrastructure, limited as it is. I'm talking, of course, of such oligarchical operations as Bungie, Cargill, Dreyfus, etc. And then he asks about the dismantling of state-owned merchant navies that used to exist and were forcefully dismantled through the conditionalities imposed by the IMF and the World Bank. And then finally, he asks if we can get a key group of leaders, including Lula da Silva and Thabo Mbeki, to reconsider in depth their self-destructive acceptance of such insane policies as increased liberalization of food trade and diversion of foodstuffs to produce uneconomic and environmentally destructive biofuels.
Well, I think that you know, it all will really depend on, you know, an open discussion about the causes of this crisis and an open discussion about the solution. Because, you know, in my call to double the food production, I take the causes back to the measures which were done by Nixon in 1971 in August, when he abandoned the old Bretton Woods system, when he got rid of the fixed exchange rates and started the bubble economy by creating the offshore money creation and the euro-dollar market. And because you have to really go back to this long-term causes, which then, you know, was the various other steps, the 74 oil price hoax, the IMF conditionality sharpening by the IMF in the middle of the 70s, the high interest rate policy of Paul Volcker in 79, Reaganomics and Thatcher economics in the in the in the 80s, and then naturally after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the unbridled free market economy of globalization, to really understand why we are right now in this breakdown crisis. And because we are in this breakdown crisis, you know, I think that people like Mbeki, Lula, and so forth, who still think, you know, because of their specific regional and, you know, also climate specificities, that they can play the game of the biofuel international mafia, I think that they will recognize that this is not going to be possible. Because, you know, the reason why I'm focusing on the food is not because we don't have a financial systemic collapse. I'm just saying that it is very difficult to explain to the ordinary person in the street why, for example, you know, the banking system is hopelessly bankrupt, because, you know, people who are not speculating or people who are not really experts, they could not care less. Even if right now, just to mention this in parentheses, the European Central Bank just now is putting out statements that they are worried that they have taken toxic waste as collaterals for bank loans to Spanish, Dutch and British banks, which right. de facto means the European Central Bank bailed out these banks because otherwise they would have gone under. But they also did it in terms of areas which are not even in the Eurozone, like a non-bank like Lehman Brothers. They accepted waste, toxic waste collaterals, and even an Australian firm specialized in auto leasing, Macquarie, it's called. So, you know, I just wrote an article in which I said, well, they are not even sticking to their own statutes, that they have to guarantee the currency. But to come back to my initial point, all of these matters are not, you know, not really getting under the skin of the majority of the people. But what does get under their skin is when they go hungry. And this is not just a question of the third world, so-called, but for example, in France, the number of pensioners who is now shoplifting in the supermarkets for food has increased by 80% in 1 year. Now, I think this is a sign of the time. And while the official inflation index in Europe is supposedly 3%, this is completely ridiculous because the inflation index consists out of things like far travel, flat screen TVs, iPods, yeah. and, you know, things which normal people buy very seldom, if at all. But if you are poor, and 54% of all families in Germany, for example, have just enough income to make it through the months, and they have no ability to put money into savings. And for them, the fact that basic foods have increased between 20, 30, 40%, it basically means, you know, if they spend 60 or 70% of their income on food, well, then they have an inflation rate of 20%, and that cuts in very severely into their living standard. So therefore, you know, both that people are affected directly and that they can see that the world is really going completely out of control when you have hunger riots in which many people have died already in Haiti, but also in several African countries. There were riots where people, you know, just died because there were clashes with the army or the police. So I think that this question of, you know, the food is really something which people can understand much better. And I think that the idea that the state has to take control of food security, and therefore eventually, you know, there will have to be laws which, you know, basically take the control away from these multinational corporations and put them back under the control of the state, is something which is a sign of the time. And I think, you know, the if many countries in Africa and Latin America are going in the direction of food security and the whole idea of biofuel becomes a morally despicable question in the eyes of the world population, I think that, you know, this can all be turned around. And I think, you know, even the European Union, I'm not sure if they will be morally able to stick to their idea to have 20% of the energy consumption, you know, coming from biofuel if this thing goes on. Because we are not, this, right now there is a line, you know, saying, oh, the food price peaked already and it will all come down. Well, I don't think so, because the underlying question is really this, you know, hyperinflationary blowout of the system. And as long as the central banks are intending, you know, to maintain the three-digit trillion toxic waste the banks are sitting on by, you know, refinancing it and having central banks buy up this junk, this problem will not go away. And I think this will continue to escalate until we have not only, you know, the physical economy back in focus, but especially the need for a new financial system is put on the agenda. And I think, you know, the fact that the new finance and economic minister in Italy, Tremonti, is a champion for a new deal and for a new Bretton Woods is a very hopeful sign. There are many important people in France who are moving in this direction. And I think the three foreign ministers of China, India, and Russia already have said that they also plan to look at the question of a global financial system. So I think, you know, it just is a question of mobilizing now in the right way. You know,
that's the key question we're posing to our listeners today. I would encourage people to go online and on LaRouchePact.com and listen to the archived webcast that Lyndon LaRouche gave on May 7th, where he took up these issues. Also, we'll be producing a pamphlet which will include as an appendix material on the food crisis, including the call from Helga. That's available to you through the website, and it's absolutely essential that we move on that. And while you're doing that, while you're reading this, and while you're thinking about what Helga's saying about the enormous potential now to shift the situation, not just in Europe, not just in Russia, China, and India, but in the United States, because we're in the midst of an election campaign where, with the exception of what LaRouchePact is doing, no one is addressing these issues on the level needed. And so our youth, our allies in the farm sector and elsewhere, our voices will be listened to. So you need to get the webcast. Go on LaRouchePact.com for that. And I'd like to see, Tim, do you have another question? And then I know we have an email question from Los Angeles. But, Tim, did you have anything else for Helga?
Yeah, actually, I do have a question. It's provoked by what I understand from the 1932 nominating convention, which was half of the votes for Roosevelt, I think, during the primary process came from crossover votes from the other party. And he had a strong base of support in the South and the West, particularly, you know, through the Farm Belt, which had been under Republican control for decades. And, you know, he went out campaigning to the farmers, to those in agriculture, promising reform and aid. And I was wondering how we can use, you know, the world food crisis and this, you know, proposed solutions to really inform this election cycle and shape the incoming presidency.
Well, I talked yesterday with a friend in India who, you know, actually called me very excitedly to tell me about this new strategic partnership. We were obviously discussing the American election campaign, and he said, well, I'm actually sympathetic to the next U.S. president because whoever it will be, he or she will have a hell to deal with and a terrible mess. And I think this is absolutely true because, you know, if you make the comparison to the economic crisis in the United States now and in the 30s, And my husband has pointed out this difference quite often. Actually, the situation structurally is much worse than then, because of the idiotic policy of globalization and outsourcing of industry. Unlike in the 30s, where you still had a lot of farm agriculture, family farms, you had middle-level industries. You have actually not much such middle-level industry in the United States anymore, and also the number of family farms has shrunk tremendously. So therefore, the next president has not only to, you know, basically overcome the depression and, you know, basically recreate a functioning national economy and a functioning agricultural situation, but, you know, you have to train the population, you have to, you know, basically go back to physical economy. And I think that from, you know, I have not been following the election campaign every day, but, you know, I look at C-SPAN and I try to get, you know, the most important speeches by Hillary Clinton and Obama and McCain and before some of the other people. And I must say, you know, looking at it from Europe, you know, the only person who has approximately addressed these issues was indeed Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I think in Europe, despite the fact that the media is in an unbelievable Goebbels-like, you know, Gleichschaltung, you know, which was the German word for when the media are all saying the same under the rules of a dictatorship. Nevertheless, you know, you did have articles in Spiegel, which is an important German magazine, saying that Obama has said nothing content-wise. He has said change, change, but from where to where he never really made clear. And it is also clear that the McCain policy would basically be a continuation of what we have right now in Washington, and that cannot be in the interest of anybody, neither in the United States nor around the world. So I think that, you know, the question of, you know, that the situation today is actually worse than in the 30s, and that therefore you need somebody who is really addressing the lower 80% of the population and their needs, and who is indeed going back to the policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and that is both a New Deal and the Bretton Woods. I think that is something you have to uniquely bring in the campaign. And, you know, I think hopefully then, you know, one or the other candidate is picking it up. So I think it's a perfect situation to really, you know, also show the whole world looks at this election campaign. This is not an American internal affair because, you know, people across the world are looking at this and say, you know, I mean, the only reason why Russia, China, and India have worked together and are moving now together is because of the unilateralism of Bush and Cheney. And, you know, I think it's very important that you bring in this international dimension to it.
Well, Helga, we have less than 2 minutes to go. What would you urge people to do to see that this FAO convention represents an opportunity for the change that you're calling for?
Well, first of all, I would like all the listeners to immediately get a copy of my call. Take that call and go to as many organizations and institutions as you possibly can, both related to farmers, farm industry, but also, you know, I mean, for example, one job in farming normally has five or so jobs related in other fields, you know, industry or transport or whatever. Get all of these organizations to send telegrams and statements to the FAO conference demanding a doubling of food, that should be the main subject on the agenda of the FAO, because what we want to have is basically a chorus of people who say that the only moral thing to do right now is to use this conference in Rome to basically announce the absolute intent to do all necessary steps to get this doubling of the food production going right away. And if we have many forces from around the world who make statements, give interviews, talk in talk shows about it, go to their state legislator, go to their congressman, go to their priest, you know, get as many resolutions, get a real mobilization, because this is maybe the last chance of civilization to turn a picture around which is threatening to bring the world to the edge of the abyss. And I think this mobilization is probably the best way of getting reason and sanity back into the economy worldwide.
Well, Helga's call is available on LaRouchePact.com. Also, I would just add to that, any campaign events, state conventions, precinct caucuses, bring this issue in, because this is the time to do it. So Helga, thank you very much for being with us today, and I'm sure that this has given people a lot to chew on, you might say, and a lot to think about. And thank you very much, and thanks to Tim and all of the people who participated. We'll see you next week, next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on The LaRouche Show.
Goodbye.
Bye.